Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Despite a spat with a Gold Star family, Florida's top Republicans are not abandoning their presidential nominee, and that doesn't sit well with some veterans.
The president represents the United States of America worldwide, and if he is lacking in empathy, that will be noted globally.
Also this week, candidate names aren't the only things on the August 30th primary ballot in Florida. How about a constitutional amendment on renewable energy?
The tangible personal property tax and the ad valorem tax increase is really a hurdle to Florida and makes Florida much more expensive to do business for them.
We'll also get the latest on the spread of Zika in Florida, not to mention the spread of Zika fear, and we'll hear about the intense and heartbreaking dispute among the survivors and families of those connected to the horrific history of the Dozier School for Boys. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's spat with the Gold Star family is putting Florida's top elected officials in an awkward position. Nick Evans has that story.
At the Democratic National Convention, Kaiser Khan questioned Donald Trump's fitness to be president.
Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing, and no one.
Trump, as he has throughout the campaign, responded forcefully. Here he is on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
I think I've made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, built great structures.
And in the same interview, he suggested Khan's wife, Ghazala, was kept from speaking.
If you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me, but plenty of people have written that.
The problem, as most know by now, is the Khan family lost their son, Captain Humayun Khan, in the Iraq War. And Trump's comments have put Florida's Republican leaders between a rock and a hard place.
Look, I've been clear. I'm never going to agree with every candidate on everything they're going to say. Like, I know who I am. I care about the military. I care about law enforcement. I was blessed to have the opportunity to serve in this country.
That's Florida Governor Rick Scott. But while he distances himself from Trump's comments, he's sticking with the candidate.
Now, I have a choice, right? I have Donald Trump over here, a business person that knows how to create jobs. Over here, I have Hillary Clinton, a career politician who's never created a job in her life. So to me, it's an easy choice. I'm gonna back the business person that actually has signed the front of a paycheck and knows how to build a company.
It's a similar story for Attorney General Pam Bondi. Here she is speaking about Captain Khan.
He saved hundreds of lives. He is an American patriot, an American hero. End of story. Would I have ever said anything about his mother standing up there silent, not saying anything? Absolutely not. That's my position.
But for some veterans, that's simply not good enough. Former Marine Colonel Jim Seaton says Trump's comments display a lack of empathy.
The president sets the tone. The president represents the United States of America worldwide, and if he is lacking in empathy, that will be noted globally, and it will set a tone that is an unhealthy tone within our own country.
And he acknowledges Scott and Bondi are in a politically difficult position.
But I think that our politicians have to, you have to stand up and be heard. It doesn't mean that you're disloyal to the candidate you're supporting, but, it just means that you're more loyal to what's right than what's convenient.
Former Navy Captain Ann Raleigh tends to vote for liberal candidates, but says she's open to nominees across the political spectrum.
They've always been people that I thought, even though I might not agree with their views on things or their ideas, but they were well thought out.
She doesn't feel the same about Trump, and it appears many in the country are leaning the same way. According to the Real Clear Politics poll average, Trump has gone from a slight edge to a 6-point deficit against Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton in the wake of Khan's speech. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
With so much emphasis on all the candidates clogging the August 30th primary ballot in Florida, it's easy to overlook the fact there's also a constitutional amendment voters will be deciding. Republican Senator Jeff Brandis of St. Petersburg is a prime author of Amendment 4. That's the legislature's renewable energy tax cut proposal on the August 30th ballot. The bipartisan measure is backed by business and environmental groups, but don't expect a TV blitz in support of the amendment. Brandis assured Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash there was enough grassroots support to push the measure over the top.
Why don't you start off with describing Amendment 4, how you think it would benefit Florida?
So Amendment 4 basically says that that the legislature can exempt from taxation solar panels installed on commercial and industrial property. We already do this for residential property, but for us to get the big bang for the buck, we're going to have to expand this out to larger solar farms, installations on top of Publix and shopping centers and Walmarts and things of that nature. We think that this is the right pathway.
Why now?
Well, I think the timing is right now because the price of solar panels has fallen about 80% in the last 10 years, and we expect it to continue to fall. And so Florida's much more cost competitive. When you look at kind of the states that have really adopted solar, the number one state in the country is Hawaii. Well, it makes sense because Hawaii has to import all of its oil for its electricity. And so the cost of electricity is extremely high in Hawaii. And the access to solar has really lowered the cost of energy for most people who live in that state. And you can kind of see that model follow across the state. Florida's right on the edge of where solar starts to make sense. It's really kind of in that middle of the pack of what it costs around the country. And so it's kind of Florida's time to really look at solar as an option. And I think it'll only get more attractive from here as the price of panels continues to come down.
Walk me through an example of how this would benefit someone who wants to install solar.
Really, the most effective way for us to gather solar is not for people to install panels on the side of their homes, although that's nice for those homeowners. It's really the most efficient way is large-scale solar farms or large rooftop installations.
So let's assume that Amendment 4 reaches the 60% majority it needs to get into the Constitution. Then the legislature has some follow-up work to do.
That's correct. It's got to come back and do the implementing bill, and that's really the fine-tuning of what we should be doing here. Do we carve out certain communities that already have this, communities where they really need that taxable revenue? Those types of conversations will have to take place. You would hate to take a project that's existing in a very small county that was counting on this type of revenue and pull that revenue out. But in order to have that conversation, we have to have the flexibility built into the Constitution. Today, we can't even have the conversation because anything that deals with ad valorem or tangible personal property tax has to go to the voters of the state of Florida.
There will be a solar amendment on the November ballot. This appears on the primary ballot. Is that the reason why, to avoid any confusion?
One, because we had unanimous support through the legislature on this, we were able to make the case that we should have that distance from some of the other questions on solar energy that are going to be decided in November.
You know, you don't have significant or organized opposition to this measure, but you don't have a lot of time either.
It really is the grassroots piece to this. It's really letting those individual constituencies know. But look, when I go back home and I talk to my constituents, solar power is one of the major things that they want to talk about, and why Florida, being the Sunshine State, doesn't have more solar energy. Now they get a say.
Thank you
very
much. Oh,
my pleasure. Great.
The Reason for Reform campaign is made up of pro-immigration reform groups from across the state and the nation. It's highlighting reasons they say more needs to be done to fix a broken immigration system in Florida and the U.S. as a whole. The campaign has spent this week highlighting contributions made by immigrants to the workforce and the economy, with reports specific to each state in the country. The group's also calling on Congress to take action on immigration reform soon. Among their number Ed Moore. He's president of the Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida, based in Tallahassee. He says there are numerous problems that legal and illegal immigrants face in Florida. One major issue, too, Moore, is how much time and money is spent training and educating foreigners, only to tell them they have to leave once they finish their studies. Moore points out that one in five residents of Florida, that's nearly 4 million people, were not born in the United States. This is a greater number of people than live in 23 other states, and he's hoping more can be accomplished once the presidential election is over and political rhetoric quiets down for a while. Still to come on Capitol Report, as the number of Florida Zika cases rise, some question how local transmissions are monitored.
With that 80% asymptomatic rate, that means that you may not immediately detect local spread of the virus.
An outbreak of locally originated Zika virus in Florida, just the latest in a string of issues and tragedies this summer. It's not yet clear how the state's tourism industry will be affected.
The number one most important reason that people select destinations is because of safety and security concerns.
And should there be an on-site memorial to honor the victims, or should the scene of old horrors instead be abandoned and forgotten? Survivors and families of those allegedly abused on the grounds of the infamous Dozier School for Boys can't agree on what happens next.
Ungodly situations in that cemetery. The bodies were scattered. You had a couple on the road. You had them under trees. You know, it just would not do justice to see them go back on that property.
The number of Zika cases in Florida is on the rise, and while government officials say local transmissions are under control, some are wondering what the real picture of Zika in Florida looks like. Regan McCarthy has more.
Florida health officials have confirmed the first cases of local Zika transmission in Florida. In fact, they're the first in the continental United States. What that means is that a person who traveled to another country was infected with Zika, came back to Florida, and was bitten by a mosquito. That mosquito then bit more people, spreading the virus. The governor says Florida's local transmissions are limited to a 1 square mile area north of Miami's downtown.
And hopefully we'll see none or at least no expansion in the area where we think there might be local transmission. Yesterday, we were able to reduce the 1 square radius down in north of downtown Miami by 10 blocks because we've done enough testing now that we feel comfortable there's not local transmission in the northwest corner of this 1 square mile radius.
Now, what's interesting is that they found these two or three cases in the beginning, but then what they had to do was go around door to door, and they asked people for samples, urine samples, to test them. That's how they found the other cases, because 80% of people don't show symptoms.
That's Derek Nimmos. He's the lead scientist for Oxitec Limited, an organization that has just received Food and Drug Administration approval to test genetically modified mosquitoes designed to create sterile offspring. His company plans to begin testing the mosquitoes in Key West, providing the community approves the plan through a local referendum in November. But his point that 80% of people who have Zika don't have symptoms raises the question. How can the Florida Department of Health know nobody else, somewhere else, has been infected? The state's Surgeon General, Celeste Phillips, says some testing has been done in other areas, but no evidence of more local transmissions was found. Cindy Prinz is a professor in epidemiology.
They're saying that because they did contact testing of two people who live in other areas but spent time in that 1 square mile area. They didn't see any positives among their contacts where they're actually living, but what they are seeing is that there were some positives among not only contacts but other people just in the neighborhood in the 1 square mile area. So for right now, I think that's why they're really saying that they're only seeing those cases locally transmitted within that area.
Prince says it's not unheard of for a mosquito-borne illness to stay in a contained space.
Dengue had shown up in Key West around 2008, 2009, and seem to just be spreading locally within the Key West area. And they actually just had another infection in Key West in June, so they had a traveler who got infected while she was in Key West with no other travel history that would put her at risk of dengue. So there still is some potential local transmission within Key West, and it just seems to stay there.
But as far as Zika goes, Prince says she wouldn't be surprised if new areas of local Zika transmission are discovered. So she and other experts are reminding Floridians to take precautions, like regularly emptying and even washing containers full of standing water, wearing bug spray and long sleeves, and taking precautions to protect themselves from the sexual spread of the virus as well. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
With tragedies at home and abroad, Florida has been inundated with bad news this summer, which can affect the public's travel plans. Kate Payne takes the pulse of the state's tourism industry.
The Sunshine State has welcomed record numbers of visitors for 5 years straight, according to the state's tourism corporation, Visit Florida. This year, Governor Rick Scott is aiming for 115 million tourists, which could translate to more than $5 billion in tax revenue. People from dozens of countries will visit Disney and Universal theme parks and perhaps drink some fresh-squeezed orange juice. And if the state's newest tourism ambassador gets his way, they'll check out the sexy beaches and hotels, too. Yes, that is the rapper Pitbull promoting the state in a music video for Visit Florida. But there are some things that not even Pitbull can fix. It's been a difficult, at times heartbreaking summer. 49 people were killed at a gay nightclub in Orlando, a 2-year-old boy was drowned by an alligator, a foul-smelling algae bloom is choking the Treasure Coast, and now there is a local outbreak of the Zika virus in the trendy Miami neighborhood of Wynwood.
All those issues could have a cumulative effect upon decision-making, which would ultimately have a trickle-down effect upon salaries, wages, and employment to local community members.
Mark Bond is a professor at Florida State University School of Hospitality, where he researches tourism. Despite the slew of tragic events, Bond says the industry hasn't taken much of a hit.
We're not seeing too much of an effect at all from Orlando in terms of occupancy in the overall performance of our lodging industry. And the same is true for the algae blooms.
But it's not yet clear how Zika will affect people's travel plans. Right now, Florida's local outbreak is centralized in a 1-square-mile section of Wynwood. It's a fashionable warehouse district, internationally known for elaborate murals and art galleries. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have issued an unprecedented stateside travel ban prohibiting pregnant women from visiting the square-mile zone. Health officials in the United Kingdom and Canada have issued travel warnings as well. But Visit Florida and local businesses on the ground say the area is safe and busy.
But we do have people on the streets. I'm out here right now, and you can't find a parking spot on 2nd Avenue, and there's people walking around, people taking pictures.
That's Tom Curator, the head of the Wynwood Business Improvement District. He's been keeping the community informed, tweeting out updates and passing around cases of bug spray. So far, only one event space has closed its doors, the Wynwood Yard. Curator says it's a precautionary step. The yard only has outdoor seating. But for some, it's business as usual.
It's like I said before, people are just going about their everyday lives and driving to work or going to a restaurant and I think trying to take proper precautions.
Beth Boone runs a local nonprofit called the Miami Light Project, and she oversees the Wynwood Arts District. She says the only thing that's out of the ordinary is all the news crews. Media coverage could distort the impact of Zika, especially for those who aren't familiar with the virus, says tourism researcher Mark Bond. But he thinks lawmakers should address the health of local communities first and foremost.
And although it's nice to think about our visitors, I think that we should address the seriousness to our local residents immediately, those who live here, because if we don't have local residents, how are we going to serve the traveling public to begin with, right?
Bond says the latest numbers on hotel occupancy for the month of July should be out in 2 weeks. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A state appeals court this week upheld a judge's decision that spared a prison inmate from being required to pay child support. The ruling by a three-judge panel of the First District Court of Appeal rejected arguments of the State Department of Revenue, which oversees the child support system. But it also urged the Florida Supreme Court to take up the issue. The case centered on an effort by the Department of Revenue to impose a child support obligation on Juan Llamas. And an administrative law judge last year declined to award child support because Llamas at the time was headed to prison on a vehicular manslaughter charge and lacked the ability to make payments, according to this week's ruling. The appeals court said the tension between a child's need for support and an incarcerated parent's inability to provide such support is unavoidable, but the ruling, written by Judge Thomas Winokur and joined fully by Judge Timothy Osterhaus, said state laws and Supreme Court precedent don't permit imputation of income for child support purposes in circumstances like this. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, there's only one meeting left before final recommendations are made on a memorial for the unclaimed remains of boys who died at the Dozier School for Boys in the Florida Panhandle. So far, there have been a lot of disagreements among Dozier Task Force members, but as Sasha Cordner, during their first meeting, reports, there was at least one memorial all sides did agree on.
The organizational meeting of the Dozier Task Force started off very cordial, as members introduced themselves, starting with Stephen Britt.
It has been a difficult few months, but I'm sure that we can come together as one cohesive group.
Because of a new state law, Britt, along with the rest of the task force, are charged with two things: create a memorial and determine its location. Some families have claimed the remains of boys who died and were buried on the Dozier grounds in Marianna. The memorial is for the unclaimed ones. It's believed they died due to alleged abuse. An excavation started a few years ago allowed Britt and his family to be DNA matched with the remains of his late uncle Robert Stevens last year.
Imagine a 14-year-old boy walking into a room with his aunts crying because their brother, who they remember was 15 the last time they saw him. I never knew I had an uncle that was murdered up here.
Task Force members can present their own memorial ideas at the next and final meeting, but it's the location that drew the most concern. After speaking to people in his community, Jackson County Commissioner Eric Hill said he believes the memorial should be in a more prominent location.
Maybe the University of South Florida or someone south of here where the population is greater, then it might serve the recognition of the individuals that were here and went through this, would be better served in a larger location.
But that angered Britt.
I'm the only one on the task force that have lost a loved one over at that facility. And for Jackson County to even insinuate that they want to move it out of their county when your ancestors performed some of the most diabolical, sadomasochistic acts known to man, here? What are you afraid of?
But Jerry Cooper, a former ward of the Dozier School, says he, like Hill, wants the memorial at another location. Calling it hell, Cooper says he was sent there as a teenager for running away a third time from an abusive home. Pointing to how long it took for the state to recognize that there were remains buried on the Dozier grounds, he didn't feel a memorial would suffice in that area.
Now, why would we want, as White House boys, to have these kids reinterred on that property when they weren't taken care of in the first place?
The White House Boys, which Cooper leads, is a group of former boys who say they suffered physical or sexual abuse or both in a building on the property labeled the White House, which he and others want destroyed. But like Britt, NAACP Tallahassee branch president Dale Landry wanted the memorial at the Dozier site.
My biggest fear is this, is that once you let it go, then it'll be forgotten. It has to be in that same site.
He suggested the church on the property as a possible memorial site, but Cooper disagreed.
Part of a report that's been done in the last few months that the FDLE opened up another investigation involving sex abuse in the Mariana School for Boys. Some of that sex abuse went on in that church. Can I change your mind?
They couldn't come to an agreement on that, and with at least two others in favor of another location, Landry called the makeup of the task force, quote, stacked, and almost left the meeting. But deciding against it, he said he'll stick it out until the very end.
The foolishness that I've seen as we're going down this trail, that really bothers me. By virtue of the fact that the private clandestine meetings and the things of this nature, it's very clear when I got in here, we saw the setup. You know, this was already predetermined. I'm hoping we can change minds before. And I hope the public will come out and be there on August the 19th to speak out. Because we need them to make sure everybody here gets the message that this is wrong.
But what brought all parties together was the unique perspective of Rhonda Dykes. She's the relative of two staffers who were killed in a 1914 dorm fire, killing at least eight other students as well.
My great-great-grandfather's name was Reuben Bennett Evans, Jr., and his son was Charles Evans. Accounts of the fire have described them as heroes as they tried to save the lives of the students in the burning dorm. The fire was so intense that when the fire victims' remains were buried, they were commingled in seven small wooden boxes and buried.
When they exhumed the remains on the property, University of South Florida researchers said they knew fire victims were included and some were identified. But Dyke says her family long ago actually paid for a burial on the Dozier grounds. Calling the on-claim remains for the Dozier children a separate issue, she added her family just wants the remains of her ancestors back for a reburial and maybe even a commemoration ceremony.
The purpose of the exhumations was to determine the causes of death of each individual. Yet there has never been a dispute of the causes of death of the fire victims. Our ancestors' remains never should have been exhumed, as it was known they were fire victims, and their general burial location has always been well known for over 100 years.
Dozier Task Force members say they'll first have to go through the proper channels to make that happen, since they're unsure if that falls under their purview, but all agreed they'd work with Dykes and her family to make that happen. Meanwhile, examples of the memorial proposals must first be sent to the Florida Department of State by Thursday. Then at the final August 19th meeting, recommendations will be discussed and there will be public comment before they go to the state legislature. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.